Maui Covenant colonists had a few ancient skimmers still in working order, but by mutual agreement there would be no overflights. Except for the dormitories, swimming beach, and the duty-free store, there was little on the island to interest us shipmen. Someday, when the last components had been brought in system by the Los Angeles and the Farcaster finished, hegemony officials would make Island 241 into a center for trade and tourism. Until then, it was a primitive place, with a dropship grid, newly finished buildings of the local white stone, and a few bored maintenance people. Mike checked the two of us out for 3 days of backpacking on the steepest and most inaccessible end of the little island. "I don't want to go backpacking, for Christ's sake," I'd said. "I'd rather stay on the L.A. and plug into a stim sim." "Shut up and follow me," said Mike. And, like a lesser member of the Pantheon following an older and wiser deity, I had shut up and followed. 2 hours of heavy tramping up the slopes through sharp-branched scrub trees brought us to a lip of lava several hundred meters above the crashing surf. We were near the equator, on a mostly tropical world, but on this exposed ledge the wind was howling, and my teeth were chattering. The sunset was a red smear between dark cumulus to the west, and I had no wish to be out in the open when full night descended. "Come on," I said. "Let's get out of the wind and build a fire. I don't know how the hell we're going to set up a tent on all of this rock." Mike sat down and lit a cannabis stick. "Take a look in your pack, kid." I hesitated. His voice had been neutral, but it was the flat neutrality of the practical joker's voice just before the bucket of water descends. I crouched down and began pawing through the nylon sack. The pack was empty, except for old flow foam packing cubes to fill it out. Those and a harlequin's costume, complete with mask and bells on the toes. "Are you goddamn crazy?" I spluttered. It was getting dark quickly now. The storm might or might not pass to the south of us. The surf was rasping below like a hungry beast. If I had known how to find my own way back to the trade compound in the dark, I might have considered leaving Mike Osho's remains to feed the fishes far below. "Now look at what's in my pack," he said. Mike dumped out some flow foam cubes and then removed some jewelry, of the type I'd seen handcrafted on Renaissance Vector. An inertial compass, a laser pen which might or might not be labeled a concealed weapon by ship security, another harlequin costume, this one tailored to his more rotund form, and a hawking mat. "Jesus, Mike," I said while running my hand over the exquisite design of the old carpet. "This can't be legal." "I didn't notice any customs agents back there," grinned Mike. "And I seriously doubt that the locals have any traffic control ordinances." "Yes, but..." I trailed off and unrolled the rest of the mat. It was a little more than a meter wide and about 2 meters long. The rich fabric had faded with age, but the flight threads were still as bright as new copper. "Where did you get it?" I asked. "Does it still work?" "On Garden," said Mike, and stuffed my costume and his other gear into his backpack. "Yes, it does." It had been more than a century since old Vladimir Sholokhov, old Earth emigrant, master lepidopterist, and EM systems engineer, had handcrafted the first hawking mat for his beautiful young niece on New Earth. Legend had it that the niece had scorned the gift, but over the decades the toys had become almost absurdly popular, more with rich adults than with children, until they were outlawed on most hegemony worlds. Dangerous to handle, a waste of shielded monofilaments, almost impossible to deal with in controlled airspace, hawking mats had become curiosities, reserved for bedtime stories, museums, and a few colony worlds. "It must have cost you a fortune," I said. 30 marks. Said Mike, and settled himself on the center of the carpet. The old dealer in Carvnell Marketplace thought it was worthless. It was, for him. I brought it back to the ship, charged it up, reprogrammed the inertia chips, and voila! Mike palmed the intricate design, and the mat stiffened and rose 15 centimeters above the rock ledge. I stared doubtfully. All right, I said. But what if it...
It won't,
said Mike, and impatiently patted the carpet behind him. It's fully charged. I know how to handle it. Come on, climb on, or stand back. I want to get going before that storm gets any closer. But I don't think... Come on, Marin! Make up your mind. I'm in a hurry. I hesitated for another second or two. If we were caught leaving the island, we would both be kicked off the ship. Shipwork was my life now. I had made that decision when I accepted the 8-mission Maui Covenant contract. More than that, I was 200 light-years and 5.5 leap-years from civilization. Even if they brought us back to hegemony space, the round trip would have cost us 11 years worth of friends and family. The time debt was irrevocable. I crawled on the hovering hawking mat behind Mike. He stuffed the backpack between us, told me to hang on, and tapped at the flight designs. The mat rose 5 meters above the ledge, banked quickly to the left, and shot out over the alien ocean. 300 meters below us, the surf crashed whitely in the deepening gloom. We rose higher above the rough water and headed north into the night. In such seconds of decision, entire futures are made. I remember talking to Siri during our second reunion, shortly after we first visited the villa along the coast near Feveron. We were walking along the beach. Alan had been allowed to stay in the city under Magritte's supervision. It was just as well. I was not truly comfortable with the boy. Only the undeniable green solemnity of his eyes and the disturbing mirror familiarity of his short, dark curls and snub of a nose served to tie him to me, to us, in my mind. That and the quick, almost sardonic smile I would catch him hiding from Siri when she reprimanded him. It was a smile too cynically amused and self-observant to be so practiced in a 10-year-old. I knew it well. I would have thought such things were learned, not inherited. "You know very little," Siri said to me. She was wading, shoeless, in a shallow tide pool. From time to time she would lift the delicate shell of a French horn conch, inspect it for flaws, and drop it back into the silty water. "I've been well trained," I replied.
"Yes, I'm sure you've been well trained," agreed Siri. "I know you are quite skillful, Marin, but you know very little."
Irritated, unsure of how to respond, I walked along with my head lowered. I dug a white lava stone out of the sand and tossed it far out into the bay. Rain clouds were piling along the eastern horizon. I found myself wishing that I was back aboard the ship. I had been reluctant to return this time, and now I knew that it had been a mistake. It was my third visit to Maui Covenant, our second reunion, as the poets and her people were calling it. I was 5 months away from being 21 standard years old. Siri had just celebrated her 37th birthday 3 weeks earlier. "I've been to a lot of places you've never seen," I said at last. It sounded petulant and childish, even to me.
"Oh, yes," said Siri, and clapped her hands together.
For a second, in her enthusiasm, I glimpsed my other Siri, the young girl I had dreamed about during the long 9 months of turnaround. Then the image slid back to harsh reality, and I was all too aware of her short hair, the loosening neck muscles, and the cords appearing on the backs of those once beloved hands.
"You've been to places I'll never see," said Siri in a rush.
Her voice was the same. Almost the same.
"Marin, my love, you've already seen things I cannot even imagine. You probably know more facts about the universe than I would guess exist. But you know very little, my darling."
"What the hell are you talking about, Siri?" I sat down on a half-submerged log near the strip of wet sand and drew my knees up like a fence between us. Siri strode out of the tide pool and came to kneel in front of me. She took my hands in hers, and although mine were bigger, heavier, blunter of finger and bone, I could feel the strength in hers. I imagined it as the strength of years I had not shared.
"You have to live to really know things, my love. Having Alon has helped me to understand that. There is something about raising a child that helps to sharpen one's sense of what is real. How do you mean?
Ciri squinted away from me for a few seconds and absently brushed back a strand of hair. Her left hand stayed firmly around both of mine.
I'm not sure, she said softly. I think one begins to feel when things aren't important. I'm not sure how to put it. When you've spent 30 years entering rooms filled with strangers, you feel less pressure than when you've had only half that number of years of experience. You know what the room and the people in it probably hold for you, and you go looking for it. If it's not there, you sense it earlier and leave to go about your business. You just know more about what is, what isn't, and how little time there is to learn the difference. Do you understand, Marin? Do you follow me even a little bit?
No, I said. Ciri nodded and bit her lower lip. But she did not speak again for a while. Instead, she leaned over and kissed me. Her lips were dry and a little questioning. I held back for a second, seeing the sky beyond her, wanting time to think. But then I felt the warm intrusion of her tongue and closed my eyes. The tide was coming in behind us. I felt a sympathetic warmth and rising as Ciri unbuttoned my shirt and ran sharp fingernails across my chest. There was a second of emptiness between us, and I opened my eyes in time to see her unfastening the last buttons on the front of her white dress. Her breasts were larger than I remembered, heavier, the nipples broader and darker. The chill air nipped at both of us until I pulled the fabric down her shoulders and brought our upper bodies together. We slid down along the log to the warm sand. I pressed her closer, all the while wondering how I possibly could have thought her the stronger one. Her skin tasted of salt. Ciri's hands helped me, her short hair pressed back against the bleached wood, white cotton and sand. My pulse outraced the surf.
"Do you understand, Marin?" she whispered to me seconds later, as her warmth connected us.
"Yes," I whispered back, but I did not. Mike brought the hawking mat in from the east toward first sight. The flight had taken over an hour in the dark, and I had spent most of the time huddling from the wind and waiting for the carpet to fold up and tumble us both into the sea. We were still half an hour out when we saw the first of the Motal Isles. Racing before the storm, tree sails billowing, the islands sailed up from their southern feeding grounds in seemingly endless procession. Many were lit brilliantly, festooned with colored lanterns and shifting veils of gossamer light.
"You sure this is the way?" I shouted.
"Yes!"
shouted Mike. He did not turn his head. The wind whipped his long black hair back against my face. From time to time he would check his compass and make small corrections to our course. It might have been easier to follow the isles. We passed one, a large one, almost half a kilometer in length, and I strained to make out details, but the isle was dark except for the glow of its phosphorescent wake. Dark shapes cut through the milky waves. I tapped Mike on the shoulder and pointed.
"Dolphins!" he shouted. "That's what this colony was all about, remember? A bunch of do-gooders during the Hegira wanted to save all the mammals in old Earth's oceans. Didn't succeed."
I would have shouted another question, but at that moment the headland and First Sight Harbor came into view. I had thought the stars were bright above Maui Covenant. I had thought the migrating islands were memorable in their colorful display. But the city of First Sight, wrapped about with harbor and hills, was a blazing beacon in the night. Its brilliance reminded me of a torch ship I once had watched while it created its own plasma nova against the dark limb of a sullen gas giant. The city was a five-tiered honeycomb of white buildings, all illuminated by warmly glowing lanterns from within and by countless torches from without. The white lava stone of the volcanic island itself seemed to glow from the city light. Beyond the town were tents, pavilions, campfires, cooking fires, and great flaming pyres,
too large for function, too large for anything except to serve as a welcome to the returning isles. The harbor was filled with boats, bobbing catamarans with cowbells clanking from their masts, large-hulled, flat-bottomed houseboats built for creeping from port to port in the calm equatorial shallows, but proudly ablaze with strings of light this night, and then the occasional ocean-going yacht, sleek and functional as a shark. A lighthouse set out on the pincer's end of the harbor reef, threw its beam far out to sea, illuminated wave and isle alike, and then swept its light back in to catch the colorful bobbing of ships and men. Even from 2 kilometers out we could hear the noise. Sounds of celebration were clearly audible. Above the shouts and constant susurration of the surf rose the unmistakable notes of a Bach flute sonata. I learned later that this welcoming chorus was transmitted through hydrophones to the passage channels, where dolphins leaped and cavorted to the music.
My God, Mike, how did you know all of this was going on?
I asked the main ship computer, said Mike. The hawking mat banked right to keep us far out from the ships and lighthouse beam. Then we curved back in north of first sight, toward a dark spit of land. I could hear the soft booming of waves on the shallows ahead.
They have this festival every year, Mike went on, but this is their sesquicentennial. The party's been going on for 3 weeks now, and is scheduled to continue another 2. There are only about 100,000 colonists on this whole world, Merrin, and I bet half of them are here, partying.
We slowed, came in carefully, and touched down on a rocky outcropping not far from the beach. The storm had missed us to the south, but intermittent flashes of lightning and the distant lights of advancing isles still marked the horizon. Overhead, the stars were not dimmed by the glow from first sight just over the rise from us. The air was warmer here, and I caught the scent of orchards on the breeze. We folded up the hawking mat and hurried to get into our harlequin costumes. Mike slipped his laser pen and jewelry into loose pockets. "What are those for?" I asked as we secured the backpack and hawking mat under a large boulder.
"These?" asked Mike, as he dangled a Renaissance necklace from his fingers. "These are currency, in case we have to negotiate for favors."
"Favors?"
"Favors," repeated Mike.
"A lady's largesse, comfort to a weary spacefarer. Nookie to you, kid."
"Oh," I said, and adjusted my mask and fool's cap. The bells made a soft sound in the dark.
"Come on," said Mike. "We'll miss the party."
I nodded and followed him, bells jangling, as we picked our way over stone and scrub toward the waiting light. I sit here in the sunlight and wait. I am not totally certain what I am waiting for. I can feel a growing warmth on my back as the morning sunlight is reflected from the white stone of Ceres' tomb.
Ceres' tomb.
There are no clouds in the sky. I raise my head and squint skyward as if I might be able to see the L.A. and the newly finished Farcaster array through the glare of atmosphere. I cannot. Part of me knows that they have not risen yet. Part of me knows to the second, the time remaining before ship and Farcaster complete their transit to the zenith. Part of me does not want to think about it.
Ciri, am I doing the right thing?
There is the sudden sound of pennants stirring on their staffs as the wind comes up. I sense, rather than see, the restlessness of the waiting crowd. For the first time since my planetfall for this, our 6th reunion, I am filled with sorrow. No, not sorrow, not yet, but a sharp-toothed sadness which soon will open into grief. For years I have carried on silent conversations with Ciri, framing questions to myself for future discussion with her, and it suddenly strikes me with cold clarity that we will never again sit together and talk. An emptiness begins to grow inside me.
Should I let it happen, Ciri?
There is no response except for the growing murmurs of the crowd. In a few minutes they will send Danelle, my younger and surviving son, or his daughter Lyra and her brother up the hill to urge me on. I toss away the sprig of willow grass I've been chewing on. There is a hint of shadow on the horizon. It could be a cloud. Or it could be the first of the isles, driven by instinct and the spring northerlies to migrate back to the great band of the equatorial shallows from whence they came. It does not matter.
Siri, am I doing the right thing?
There is no answer, and the time grows shorter. Sometimes Siri seemed so ignorant it made me sick. She knew nothing of my life away from her. She would ask questions, but I sometimes wondered if she was interested in the answers. I spent many hours explaining the beautiful physics behind our spin ships, but she never did seem to understand. Once, after I had taken great care to detail the differences between their ancient siege ship and the Los Angeles, Siri astounded me by asking, "But why did it take my ancestors 80 years of ship time to reach Maui Covenant, when you can make the trip in 130 days? She had understood nothing. Siri's sense of history was, at best, pitiful. She viewed the hegemony and the world web the way a child would view the fantasy world of a pleasant but rather silly myth. There was an indifference there that almost drove me mad at times. Siri knew all about the early days of the Hegira, at least insofar as they pertained to the Maui Covenant and the colonists, and she occasionally would come up with delightful bits of archaic trivia or phraseology, but she knew nothing of post-Hegira realities. Names like Garden and the Ousters, Renaissance and Lussis meant little to her. I could mention Salmid Brevi or General Horace Glennon Height, and she would have no associations or reactions at all. None. The last time I saw Siri, she was 70 standard years old. She was 70 years old, and still she had never traveled off-world, used a fat line, tasted any alcoholic drink except wine, interfaced with an empathy surgeon, stepped through a Farcaster door, smoked a cannabis stick, received gene tailoring, plugged into a stim sim, received any formal schooling, taken any RNA medication, heard of Zen Gnostics or the Shrike Church, or flown any vehicle except an ancient Vicken skimmer belonging to her family. Siri had never made love to anyone except me, or so she said, and so I believed. It was during our first reunion, that time on the archipelago, when Siri took me to talk with the dolphins. We had risen to watch the dawn. The highest levels of the treehouse were a perfect place from which to watch the eastern sky pale and fade to morning. Ripples of high cirrus turned to rose, and then the sea itself grew molten as the sun floated above the flat horizon.
"Let's go swimming," said Siri.
The rich horizontal light bathed her skin and threw her shadow 4 meters across the boards of the platform. "I'm too tired," I said. "Later." We had lain awake most of the night, talking, making love, talking and making love again. In the glare of morning, I felt empty and vaguely nauseated. I sensed the slight movement of the aisle under me as a tinge of vertigo, a drunkard's disconnection from gravity.
"No, let's go now," said Siri, and grasped my hand to pull me along.
I was irritated, but did not argue. Siri was 26, 7 years older than I during that first reunion. But her impulsive behavior often reminded me of the teenaged Siri I had carried away from the festival only 10 of my months earlier. Her deep, unself-conscious laugh was the same. Her green eyes cut as sharply when she was impatient. The long mane of auburn hair had not changed, but her body had ripened, filled out with a promise which had been only hinted at before. Her breasts were still high and full, almost girlish, bordered above by freckles that gave way to a whiteness so translucent that a gentle blue tracery of veins could be seen. But they were different, somehow. She was different.
"Are you going to join me, or just sit there staring?" asked Siri.
She had slipped off her caftan as we came out onto the lowest deck. Our small ship was still tied to the dock.
Above us, the island's tree sails were beginning to open to the morning breeze. For the past several days, Ciri had insisted on wearing swim strips when we went into the water. She wore none now. Her nipples rose in the cool air. "Won't we be left behind?" I asked, squinting up at the flapping tree sails. On previous days, we had waited for the doldrums in the middle of the day, when the isle was still in the water, the sea a glazed mirror. Now the jib vines were beginning to pull taut as the thick leaves filled with wind.
"Don't be silly," said Ciri. "We could always catch a keel root and follow it back. That or a feeding tendril. Come on."
She tossed an osmosis mask at me and donned her own. The transparent film made her face look slick with oil. From the pocket of her caftan, she lifted a thick medallion and set it in place around her neck. The metal looked dark and ominous against her skin.
"What's that?" I asked.
Ciri did not lift the osmosis mask to answer. She set the comm threads in place against her neck and handed me the earplugs. Her voice was tinny.
"Translation disc," she said. "Thought you knew all about gadgets, Marin. Last one in's a sea slug."
She held the disc in place between her breasts with one hand and stepped off the aisle. I could see the pale globes of her buttocks as she pirouetted and kicked for depth. In seconds, she was only a white blur deep in the water. I slipped my own mask on, pressed the comm threads tight, and stepped into the sea. The bottom of the aisle was a dark stain on a ceiling of crystalline light. I was wary of the thick feeding tendrils, even though Ciri had amply demonstrated that they were interested in devouring nothing larger than the tiny zooplankton that even now caught the sunlight like dust in an abandoned ballroom. Keel roots descended like gnarled stalactites for hundreds of meters into the purple depths. The aisle was moving. I could see the faint fibrillation of the tendrils as they trailed along. A wake caught the light 10 meters above me. For a second, I was choking, the gel of the mask smothering me as surely as the surrounding water would. And then I relaxed, and the air flowed freely into my lungs.
"Deeper, Marin," came Ciri's voice.
I blinked, a slow-motion blink as the mask readjusted itself over my eyes, and caught sight of Ciri 20 meters lower, grasping a keel root and trailing effortlessly above the colder, deeper currents where the light did not reach. I thought of the thousands of meters of water under me, of the things which might lurk there, unknown, unsought out by the human colonists. I thought of the dark and the depths, and my scrotum tightened involuntarily.
"Come on down!"
Ciri's voice was an insect buzz in my ears. I rotated and kicked. The buoyancy here was not so great as in old Earth's seas, but it still took energy to dive so deep. The mask compensated for depth and nitrogen, but I could feel the pressure against my skin and ears. Finally, I quit kicking, grabbed a keel root, and roughly hauled myself down to Ciri's level. We floated side by side in the dim light. Ciri was a spectral figure here, her long hair swirling in a wine-dark nimbus, the pale strips of her body glowing in the blue-green light. The surface seemed impossibly distant. The widening V of the wake and the drift of the scores of tendrils showed that the isle was moving more quickly now, moving mindlessly to other feeding grounds, distant waters.
"Where are the—"
I began to sub-vocalize.
"Shh," said Ciri.
She fiddled with the medallion. I could hear them then, the shrieks and trills and whistles and cat purrs and echoing cries. The depths were suddenly filled with strange music.
"Jesus," I said,
and because Ciri had tuned our comm threads to the translator, the word was broadcast as a senseless whistle and toot.
"Hello,"
she called, and the translated greeting echoed from the transmitter, a high-speed bird's call sliding into the ultrasonic.
"Hello," she called again.
Minutes passed before the dolphins came to investigate. They rolled past us, surprisingly large, alarmingly large.
their skin looking slick and muscled in the uncertain light. A large one swam within a meter of us, turning at the last moment so that the white of his belly curved past us like a wall. I could see the dark eye rotate to follow me as he passed. One stroke of his wide fluke kicked up a turbulence strong enough to convince me of the animal's power. "Hello," called Ciri, but the swift form faded into distant haze, and there was a sudden silence. Ciri clicked off the translator. "Do you want to talk to them?" she asked. "Sure." I was dubious. More than 3 centuries of effort had not raised much of a dialogue between man and sea mammal. Mike had once told me that the thought structures of Old Earth's 2 groups of orphans were too different, the reference too few. One pre-Hegira expert had written that speaking to a dolphin or porpoise was about as rewarding as speaking to a 1-year-old human infant. Both sides usually enjoyed the exchange, and there was a simulacrum of conversation, but neither party would come away the more knowledgeable. Ciri switched the translator disc back on. "Hello?" I said. There was a final minute of silence, and then our earphones were buzzing while the sea echoed shrill ululations.
"Distance, no fluke. Hello, tone. Current pulse. Circle me. Funny?"
"What the hell?" I asked Ciri, and the translator trilled out my question. Ciri was grinning under her osmosis mask. I tried again. "Hello. Greetings from, the surface. How are you?" The large male, I assumed it to be a male, curved in toward us like a torpedo. He arch-kicked his way through the water 10 times faster than I could have swum, even if I had remembered to don flippers that morning. For a second I thought he was going to ram us, and I raised my knees and clung tightly to the keel root. Then he was past us, climbing for air, while Ciri and I reeled from his turbulent wake and the high tones of his shout.
"No fluke! No feed! No swim! No play! No fun!"
Ciri switched off the translator and floated closer. She lightly grasped my shoulders while I held on to the keel root with my right hand. Our legs touched as we drifted through the warm water. A school of tiny crimson warrior fish flickered above us, while the dark shapes of the dolphins circled farther out.
"Had enough?"
she asked. Her hand was flat on my chest.
"One more try," I said.
Ciri nodded and twisted the disc to life. The current pushed us together again. She slid her arm around me.
"Why do you herd the islands?"
I asked the bottlenosed shapes circling in the dappled light.
"How does it benefit you to stay with the isles?"
"Sounding now. Old songs. Deep water. No great voices. No shark. Old songs. New songs."
Ciri's body lay along the length of me now. Her left arm tightened around me.
"Great voices were the whales,"
she whispered. Her hair fanned out in streamers. Her right hand moved down and seemed surprised at what it found.
"Do you miss the great voices?"
I asked the shadows. There was no response. Ciri slid her legs around my hips. The surface was a churning bowl of light 40 meters above us.
"What do you miss most of Old Earth's oceans?" I asked.
With my left arm, I pulled Ciri closer, slid my hand down along the curve of her back to where her buttocks rose to meet my palm, held her tight. To the circling dolphins, we must have appeared a single creature. Ciri lifted herself against me, and we became a single creature. The translator disc had twisted around, so it trailed over Ciri's shoulder. I reached to shut it off, but paused as the answer to my question buzzed urgently in our ears.
"Miss Shark! Miss Shark! Miss Shark! Miss Shark! 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 Shark!"
I turned off the disc and shook my head. I did not understand. There was so much I did not understand. I closed my eyes,
as Ciri and I moved gently to the rhythms of the current and ourselves, while the dolphins swam nearby and the cadence of their calls took on the sad, slow trilling of an old lament. Ciri and I came down out of the hills and returned to the festival just before sunrise of the second day. For a night and a day we had roamed the hills, eaten with strangers in pavilions of orange silk, bathed together in the icy waters of the Shri, and danced to the music which never ceased going out to the endless file of passing aisles. We were hungry. I had awakened at sunset to find Ciri gone. She returned before the moon of Maui Covenant rose. She told me that her parents had gone off with friends for several days on a slow-moving houseboat. They had left the family skimmer in first sight. Now we worked our way from dance to dance, bonfire to bonfire, back to the center of the city. We planned to fly west to her family estate near Feverone. It was very late, but First Sight Common still had its share of revelers. I was very happy. I was 19, and I was in love, and the 0.93 gravity of Maui Covenant seemed much less to me. I could have flown, had I wished. I could have done anything. We had stopped at a booth and bought fried dough and mugs of black coffee. Suddenly a thought struck me. I asked, "How did you know I was a shipman?" "Hush, friend Merrin. Eat your poor breakfast. When we get to the villa, I will fix a true meal to break our fast." "No, I'm serious," I said, and wiped grease off my chin with the sleeve of my less-than-clean harlequin's costume. "This morning you said that you knew right away last night that I was from the ship. Why was that? Was it my accent? My costume? Mike and I saw other fellows dressed like this." Ciri laughed and brushed back her hair. "Just be glad it was I who spied you out, Merrin, my love. Had it been my Uncle Gresham or his friends, it would have meant trouble." "Oh? Why is that?" I picked up one more fried ring, and Ciri paid for it. I followed her through the thinning crowd. Despite the motion and the music all about, I felt weariness beginning to work on me. "They are separatists," said Ciri. "Uncle Gresham recently gave a speech before the council urging that we fight rather than agree to be swallowed into your hegemony. He said that we should destroy your Farcaster device before it destroys us." "Oh," I said. "Did he say how he was going to do that? The last I heard, you folks had no craft to get off-world in." "Nay, nor for the past 50 years have we," said Ciri. "But it shows how irrational the Separatists can be." I nodded. Shipmaster Singh and Counselor Halman had briefed us on the so-called Separatists of Maui Covenant. "The usual coalition of colonial jingoists and throwbacks," Singh had said. "Another reason we go slow and develop the world's trade potential before finishing the Farcaster. The World Web doesn't need these yahoos coming in prematurely. And groups like the Separatists are another reason to keep you crew and construction workers the hell away from the groundlings." "Where is your skimmer?" I asked. The common was emptying quickly. Most of the bands had packed up their instruments for the night. Gaily costumed heaps lay snoring on the grass or cobblestones amid the litter and unlit lanterns. Only a few enclaves of merriment remained, groups dancing slowly to a lone guitar or singing drunkenly to themselves. I saw Mike Osho at once, a patchworked fool, his mask long gone, a girl on either arm. He was trying to teach the Hava Nagila to a rapt but inept circle of admirers. One of the troupe would stumble, and they would all fall down. Mike would flog them to their feet among general laughter, and they would start again, hopping clumsily to his basso profundo chant. "There it is," said Ciri, and pointed to a short line of skimmers parked behind the common hall. I nodded and waved to Mike, but he was too busy hanging on to his two ladies to notice me. Ciri and I had crossed the square and were in the shadows of the old building when the shout went up. "Shipman! Turn around, you hegemony son of a bitch!" I froze, and then wheeled around with fists clenched, but no one was near me. Six young men had descended the steps from the grandstand and were standing in a semicircle behind Mike. The man in front was tall, slim, and strikingly handsome. He was 25 or 26 years old, and his long blonde curls spilled down on a crimson silk suit that emphasized his physique. In his right hand he carried a meter-long sword that looked to be of tempered steel. Mike turned slowly. Even from a distance I could see his eyes sobering as he surveyed the situation. The women at his side, and a couple of the young men in his group, tittered as if something humorous had been said. Mike allowed the inebriated grin to stay on his face.
"You address me, sir?" he asked.
"I address you, you hegemony whore's son," hissed the leader of the group. His handsome face was twisted into a sneer.
"Bertol," whispered Ciri, "my cousin, Gresham's younger son."
I nodded and stepped out of the shadows. Ciri caught my arm.
"That is twice you have referred unkindly to my mother, sir," slurred Mike. "Have she or I offended you in some way? If so, 1,000 pardons."
Mike bowed so deeply that the bells on his cap almost brushed the ground. Members of his group applauded.
"Your presence offends me, you hegemony bastard! You stink up our air with your fat carcass!"
Mike's eyebrows rose comically. A young man near him in a fish costume waved his hand.
"Oh, come on, Bertol, he's just—"
"Shut up, Ferrick! It is this fat shithead I am speaking to."
"Shithead?" repeated Mike, eyebrows still raised.
"I've traveled 200 light-years to be called a fat shithead. It hardly seems worth it."
He pivoted gracefully, untangling himself from the women as he did so.
I would have joined Mike then, but Ciri clung tightly to my arm, whispering unheard entreaties.
When I was free, I saw that Mike was still smiling, still playing the fool. But his left hand was in his baggy shirt pocket.
"Give him your blade, Craig," snapped Bertol.
One of the younger men tossed a sword, hilt first, to Mike. Mike watched it arc by and clang loudly on the cobblestones.
"You can't be serious," said Mike, in a soft voice that was suddenly quite sober. "You cretinous cow-turd! Do you really think I'm going to play duel with you, just because you get a hard-on acting the hero for these yokels?"
"Pick up the sword!" screamed Bertol, "or by God I'll carve you where you stand!"
He took a quick step forward, the youth's face contorted with fury as he advanced.
"Fuck off," said Mike.
In his left hand was the laser pen.
"No!" I yelled, and ran into the light.
That pen was used by construction workers to scrawl marks on girders of whiskered alloy.
Things happened very quickly then.
Bertol took another step, and Mike flicked the green beam across him almost casually. The colonist let out a cry and leaped back. A smoking line of black was slashed diagonally across his silk shirt front. I hesitated. Mike had the setting as low as it could go. Two of Bertol's friends started forward, and Mike swung the light across their shins. One dropped to his knees, cursing, and the other hopped away, holding his leg and hooting. A crowd had gathered. They laughed as Mike swept off his fool's cap in another bow.
"I thank you," said Mike. "My mother thanks you."
Ciri's cousin strained against his rage. Froths of spittle spilled on his lips and chin. I pushed through the crowd and stepped between Mike and the tall colonist.
"Hey, it's all right," I said. "We're leaving. We're going now."
"God damn it, Marin, get out of the way," said Mike.
"It's all right," I said as I turned to him. "I'm with a girl named Ciri, who has a—"
Bertol stepped forward and lunged past me with his blade. I wrapped my left arm around his shoulder and flung him back. He tumbled heavily onto the grass.
"Oh, shit,"
said Mike as he backed up several paces. He looked tired and a little disgusted as he sat down on a stone step.
"Aw, damn," he said softly.
There was a short line of crimson in one of the black patches on the left side of his harlequin costume. As I watched, the narrow slit spilled over, and blood ran down across Mike Osho's broad belly.
"Oh, Jesus, Mike!"
I tore a strip of fabric from my shirt and tried to staunch the flow. I could remember none of the first aid we'd been taught as midshipmen. I pawed at my wrist, but my comm log was not there. We had left them on the Los Angeles.
"It's not so bad, Mike," I gasped. "It's just a little cut."
The blood flowed down over my hand and wrist.
"It will serve," said Mike.
His voice was held taut by a cord of pain.
"Damn! A fucking sword! Do you believe it, Marin? Cut down in the prime of my prime by a piece of fucking cutlery out of a fucking one-penny opera. Oh, damn, that smarts!"
"Three-penny opera," I said, and changed hands. The rag was soaked.
"You know what your fucking problem is, Marin? You're always sticking your fucking 2 cents in." "Oh!"
Mike's face went white and then gray. He lowered his chin to his chest and breathed deeply.
"To hell with this, kid. Let's go home, huh?"
I looked over my shoulder. Bertol was slowly moving away with his friends. The rest of the crowd milled around in shock.
"Call a doctor!" I screamed. "Get some medics up here!"
2 men ran down the street. There was no sign of Siri.
"Wait a minute! Wait a minute!"
said Mike in a stronger voice, as if he had forgotten something important.
"Just a minute," he said,
and died. Died. A real death. Brain death. His mouth opened obscenely. His eyes rolled back, so only the whites showed. And a minute later, the blood ceased pumping from the wound. For a few mad seconds, I cursed the sky. I could see the L.A. moving across the fading starfield, and I knew that I could bring Mike back if I could get him there in a few minutes. The crowd backed away as I screamed and ranted at the stars. Eventually I turned to Bertol.
"You," I said.
The young man had stopped at the far end of the common. His face was ashen. He stared wordlessly.
"You,"
I said again. I picked up the laser pen from where it had rolled, clicked the power to maximum, and walked to where Bertol and his friends stood waiting. Later, through the haze of screams and scorched flesh, I was dimly aware of Ceres' skimmer setting down in the crowded square, of dust flying up all around, and of her voice commanding me to join her. We lifted away from the light and madness. The cool wind blew my sweat-soaked hair away from my neck.
"We will go to Feveron," said Siri. "Bertol was drunk. The Separatists are a small, violent group. There will be no reprisals. You will stay with me until the Council holds the inquest."
"No," I said.
"There. Land there."
I pointed to a spit of land not far from the city. Siri landed, despite her protests. I glanced at the boulder to make sure the backpack was still there, and then climbed out of the skimmer. Siri slid across the seat and pulled my head down to hers.
"Marin, my love."
Her lips were warm and open, but I felt nothing. My body felt anesthetized. I stepped back and waved her away. She brushed her hair back and stared at me from green eyes filled with tears. Then the skimmer lifted, turned, and sped to the south in the early morning light.
"Just a minute," I felt like calling.
I sat on a rock and gripped my knees as several ragged sobs were torn up out of me. Then I stood and threw the laser pen into the surf below. I tugged out the backpack and dumped the contents on the ground. The hawking mat was gone. I sat back down, too drained to laugh or cry or walk away. The sun rose as I sat there. I was still sitting there 3 hours later when the large black skimmer from ship security set down silently beside me.
"Father? Father, it is getting late."
I turned to see my son, Donnell, standing behind me. He is wearing the blue and gold robe of the Hegemony Council. His bald scalp is flushed and beaded with sweat. Donnell is only 43, but he seems much older to me.
"Please, father," he says.
I nod and rise, brushing off the grass and dirt. We walk together to the front of the tomb. The crowd is pressed closer now. Gravel crunches under their feet as they shift restlessly.
"Shall I enter with you, father?"
Donnell asks. I pause to look at this aging stranger who is my child. There is little of Ciri or me reflected in him. His face is friendly, florid, and tense with the excitement of the day. I can sense in him the open honesty which often takes the place of intelligence in some people. I cannot help but compare this balding puppy of a man to Alon. Alon of the dark curls and silences and sardonic smile. But Alon is 33 years dead, cut down in a stupid battle which had nothing to do with him. "No," I say. "I'll go in by myself. Thank you, Donnell." He nods and steps back. The pennants snap above the heads of the straining crowd. I turn my attention to the tomb. The entrance is sealed with a palm lock. I have only to touch it. During the past few minutes, I have developed a fantasy which will save me from both the growing sadness within and the external series of events which I have initiated. Ciri is not dead. In the last stages of her illness, she had called together the doctors and the few technicians left in the colony, and they rebuilt for her one of the ancient hibernation chambers used in their seed ship 2 centuries earlier. Ciri is only sleeping. What is more, the year-long sleep has somehow restored her youth. When I wake her, she will be the Ciri I remember from our early days. We will walk out into the sunlight together, and when the Farcaster doors open, we shall be the first through.
Father?
Yes. I step forward and set my hand to the door of the crypt. There is a whisper of electric motors, and the white slab of stone slides back. I bow my head and enter Ciri's tomb.
Damn it, Merrin! Secure that line before it knocks you overboard! Hurry!
I hurried. The wet rope was hard to coil, harder to tie off. Ciri shook her head in disgust and leaned over to tie a bowline knot with one hand. It was our 6th reunion. I had been 3 months too late for her birthday, but more than 5,000 other people had made it to the celebration. The CEO of the All Thing had wished her well in a 40-minute speech. A poet read his most recent verses to the Love Cycle sonnets. The hegemony ambassador had presented her with a scroll and a new ship, a small submersible powered by the first fusion cells to be allowed on Maui Covenant. Ciri had 18 other ships. 12 belonged to her fleet of swift catamarans that plied their trade between the wandering archipelago and the home islands. 2 were beautiful racing yachts that were used only twice a year to win the Founders' Regatta and the Covenant Criterium. The other 4 craft were ancient fishing boats, homely and awkward, well-maintained but little more than scows. Ciri had 19 ships, but we were on a fishing boat, the Ginny Paul. For the past 8 days we had fished the shelf of the equatorial shallows, a crew of 2, casting and pulling nets, wading knee-deep through stinking fish and crunching trilobites, wallowing over every wave, casting and pulling nets, keeping watch, and sleeping like exhausted children during our brief rest periods. I was not quite 23. I thought I was used to heavy labor aboard the L.A., and it was my custom to put in an hour of exercise in the 1.3G pod every 2nd shift. But now my arms and back ached from the strain, and my hands were blistered between the calluses. Ciri had just turned 70.
"Merrin, go forward and reef the foresail. Do the same for the jib, and then go below to see to the sandwiches. Plenty of mustard."
I nodded and went forward. For a day and a half we'd been playing hide-and-seek with a storm, sailing before it when we could, turning about and accepting its punishment when we had to. At first it had been exciting, a welcome respite from the endless casting and pulling and mending. But after the first few hours, the adrenaline rush faded, to be replaced by constant nausea, fatigue, and a terrible tiredness. The seas did not relent. The waves grew to 6 meters and higher. The Ginny Paul wallowed like the broad-beamed matron she was. Everything was wet. My skin was soaked under 3 layers of rain gear. For Siri, it was a long-awaited vacation. "This is nothing," she had said, during the darkest hour of the night, as waves washed over the deck and smashed against the scarred plastic of the cockpit. "You should see it during simoon season." The clouds still hung low and blended into gray waves in the distance, but the sea was down to a gentle 5-foot chop. I spread mustard across the roast beef sandwiches and poured steaming coffee into thick white mugs. It would have been easier to transport the coffee in 0G without spilling it than to get up the pitching shaft of the companionway. Siri accepted her depleted cup without commenting. We sat in silence for a bit, appreciating the food and the tongue-scalding warmth. I took the wheel when Siri went below to refill our mugs. The gray day was dimming almost imperceptibly into night. "Marin," she said after handing me my mug and taking a seat on the long, cushioned bench which encircled the cockpit. "What will happen after they open the Farcaster?" I was surprised by the question. We had almost never talked about the time when Maui Covenant would join the hegemony. I glanced over at Siri and was struck by how ancient she suddenly seemed. Her face was a mosaic of seams and shadows. Her beautiful green eyes had sunken into wells of darkness, and her cheekbones were knife edges against brittle parchment. She kept her gray hair cut short now, and it stuck out in damp spikes. Her neck and wrists were tendoned cords emerging from a shapeless sweater. "What do you mean?" I asked. "What will happen after they open the Farcaster?" "You know what the Council says, Siri." I spoke loudly because she was hard of hearing in one ear. "It will open a new era of trade and technology for Maui Covenant, and you won't be restricted to one little world any longer. When you become citizens, everyone will be entitled to use the Farcaster doors." "Yes," said Siri. Her voice was weary. "I have heard all of that, Marin. But what will happen? Who will be the first through to us?" I shrugged. "More diplomats, I suppose. Cultural contact specialists, anthropologists, ethnologists, marine biologists." "And then?" I paused. It was dark out. The sea was almost gentle. Our running lights glowed red and green against the night. I felt the same anxiety I had known 2 days earlier when the wall of storm appeared on the horizon. I said, "And then will come the missionaries, the petroleum geologists, the sea farmers, the developers." Siri sipped at her coffee. "I would have thought your hegemony was far beyond a petroleum economy." I laughed and locked the wheel in. "Nobody gets beyond a petroleum economy, not while there's petroleum there. We don't burn it, if that's what you mean, but it's still essential for the production of plastics, synthetics, food base and keroids. 200 billion people use a lot of plastic."
"And Maui Covenant has oil?"
"Oh, yes," I said. There was no more laughter in me. "There are billions of barrels reservoired under the equatorial shallows alone."
"How will they get it, Marin? Platforms?"
"Yeah, platforms. Submersibles. Subsea colonies with tailored workers brought in from Mare Infinitus."
"And the Motal Isles?" asked Siri. "They must return each year to the shallows to feed on the blue kelp there and to reproduce. What will become of the isles?"
I shrugged again. I had drunk too much coffee, and it had left a bitter taste in my mouth. "I don't know," I said. "They haven't told the crew much. But back on our first trip out, Mike heard that they plan to develop as many of the isles as they can, so some will be protected."
"Develop?"
Ciri's voice showed surprise for the first time. How can they develop the isles? Even the first families must ask permission of the sea folk to build our treehouse retreats there. I smiled at Ciri's use of the local term for the dolphins. The Maui Covenant colonists were such children when it came to their damned dolphins. The plans are all set, I said. There are 128,573 motal isles big enough to build a dwelling on. Leases to those have long since been sold. The smaller isles will be broken up, I suppose. The home islands will be developed for recreation purposes. Recreation purposes? Echoed Ciri. How many people from the hegemony will use the Farcaster to come here? For recreation purposes? At first, you mean? I asked. Just a few thousand the first year. As long as the only door is on Island 241, the trade center, it will be limited. Perhaps 50,000 the second year, when First Sight gets its door? It'll be quite the luxury tour. Always is after a seed colony is first opened to the web. And later? After the 5-year probation. There will be thousands of doors, of course. I would imagine there will be 20 or 30 million new residents coming through during the first year of full citizenship. 20 or 30 million, said Ciri. The light from the compass stand illuminated her lined face from below. There was still a beauty there. But there was no anger or shock. I had expected both. But you'll be citizens then yourself, I said, free to step anywhere in the world web. There will be 16 new worlds to choose from, probably more by then. Yes, said Ciri, and set aside her empty mug. A fine rain streaked the glass around us. The crude radar screen set in its hand-carved frame showed the seas empty. The storm passed. Is it true, Marin, that people in the hegemony have their homes on 12 worlds? One house, I mean, with windows facing out on 12 skies. Sure, I said, but not many people. Only the rich can afford multi-world residences like that. Ciri smiled and set her hand on my knee. The back of her hand was mottled and blue-veined. But you are very rich, are you not, shipman? I looked away. Not yet, I'm not. Ah, but soon, Marin, soon. How long for you, my love? Less than 2 weeks here, and then the voyage back to your hegemony. 5 months more of your time to bring the last components back, a few weeks to finish, and then you step home, a rich man. Step 200 empty light-years home. What a strange thought. But where was I? That is, how long? Less than a standard year. 10 months, I said. 306 standard days, 314 of yours, 918 shifts. And then your exile will be over. Yes. And you will be 24 years old and very rich. Yes. I'm tired, Marin. I want to sleep now. We programmed the tiller, set the collision alarm, and went below. The wind had risen some, and the old vessel wallowed from wave crest to trough with every swell. We undressed in the dim light of the swinging lamp. I was first in the bunk and under the covers. It was the first time Ciri and I had shared a sleep period. Remembering our last reunion and her shyness at the villa, I expected her to douse the light. Instead, she stood a minute, nude in the chill air, thin arms calmly at her sides. Time had claimed Ciri, but had not ravaged her. Gravity had done its inevitable work on her breasts and buttocks, and she was much thinner. I stared at the gaunt outlines of ribs and breastbone, and remembered the 16-year-old girl with baby fat and skin like warm velvet. In the cold light of the swinging lamp, I stared at Ciri's sagging flesh, and remembered moonlight on budding breasts. Yet somehow, strangely, inexplicably, it was the same Ciri who stood before me now. "Move over, Marin." She slipped into the bunk beside me. The sheets were cool against our skin, the rough blanket welcome. I turned off the light. The little ship swayed to the regular rhythm of the sea's breathing. I could hear the sympathetic creak of masts and rigging. In the morning, we would be casting and pulling and mending. But now there was time to sleep. I began to doze to the sound of waves against wood.
Merrin?
Yes.
What would happen if the Separatists attacked the hegemony tourists or the new residents?
I thought the Separatists had all been carted off to the Isles.
They have been, but what if they resisted?
The hegemony would send in force troops who could kick the shit out of the Separatists.
What if the Farcaster itself were attacked, destroyed before it was operational?
Impossible.
Yes, I know, but what if it were?
Then the Los Angeles would return 9 months later, with hegemony troops who would proceed to kick the shit out of the Separatists, and anyone else on Maui Covenant who got in their way.
9 months ship time, said Siri. 11 years of our time.
But inevitable either way, I said. Let's talk about something else.
All right, said Siri.
But we did not speak. I listened to the creak and sigh of the ship. Siri had nestled into the hollow of my arm. Her head was on my shoulder, and her breathing was so deep and regular that I thought her to be asleep. I was almost asleep myself when her warm hand slid up my leg and lightly cupped me. I was startled, even as I began to stir and stiffen. Siri whispered an answer to my unasked question.
No, Merrin, one is never really too old, at least not too old to want the warmth and closeness. You decide, my love. I will be content either way.
I decided. Toward the dawn, we slept. The tomb is empty. Donnell, come in here. He bustles in, robes rustling in the hollow emptiness. The tomb is empty. There is no hibernation chamber. I did not truly expect there to be one. But neither is there sarcophagus or coffin. A bright bulb illuminates the white interior. What the hell is this, Donnell? I thought this was Ciri's tomb.
It is, Father.
Where is she interred? Under the floor, for Christ's sake? Donnell mops at his brow. I remember that it is his mother I am speaking of. I also remember that he has had almost 2 years to accustom himself to the idea of her death.
No one told you? He asks.
Told me what? The anger and confusion are already ebbing. I was rushed here from the dropship station and told that I was to visit Ciri's tomb before the Farcaster opening. What?
Mother was cremated as per her instructions. Her ashes were spread on the Great South Sea from the highest platform of the family aisle.
Then why this crypt? I watch what I say. Donnell is sensitive. He mops his brow again and glances to the door. We are shielded from the view of the crowd, but we are far behind schedule. Already the other members of the council have had to hurry down the hill to join the dignitaries on the bandstand. My slow grief this day has been worse than bad timing. It has turned into bad theater.
Mother left instructions. They were carried out.
He touches a panel on the inner wall, and it slides up to reveal a small niche containing a metal box. My name is on it. What is that? Donnell shakes his head.
Personal items Mother left for you. Only Magritte knew the details, and she died last winter without telling anyone.
All right, I said. Thank you. I'll be out in a moment. Donnell glances at his chronometer.
The ceremony begins in